We'd like to take a second to thank our sponsor, Mouser Electronics. Not only does Mouser stock the world's widest selection of semiconductors and electronic components, they also offer an original content series called Empowering Innovation Together. Each month, EIT takes a deep dive into the hottest tech trends, and this month the focus is on 5G. Check out podcasts, articles, infographics, videos, and more at mouser.com/empowering-innovation.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Reviews Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, it is all about Google I.O. 2021, and also a couple of reviews from the latest Apple products. We'll be chatting about the iPad Pro and the iMac M1. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to the Engadget Podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes because I swear those little reviews and star ratings actually matter. And if you want to drop us a question, shoot us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Let's just kick off with Google I.O. And joining us to talk about that is our senior mobile editor, Chris Velasco, who did all this with Sherlyn. Hello, Chris.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi, and I will say up front to our listeners, Chris and Sherlyn did a post-IO recap that is up on our YouTube stream. We didn't have a chance to put that in the podcast channel, but it is worth listening to as well. But yeah, let's talk about some high-level stuff. So what was up with Google I.O. this year? I'm just wondering, like, what is your broad takeaway for both of you?
My main one, and let me, I don't mind, I don't know if we have the same thought, V, but my main takeaway is that, like, since Google didn't have an I.O. last year and it did this year, there was news across all, like, all of its ecosystem so much. This was a two-hour-long event, and Google has made, you know, changes to so many things that it almost bored us with some of the stuff because the early parts were very dry. And then the meat and potatoes, Android and consumer software side of things were later in the show. So I think Google flexed kind of the breadth of its like product portfolio at Google I.O. It just reminded everyone, like, this is how much, you know, of your business we have business in. And it's like, you can't, you just, it's sometimes
you can't
easy to forget.
Us.
Yeah, it's easy to forget Google is in every facet of your life, but then it's
man. And also future facets like 3D meetings and whatnot. V, what did you think? Because you're also coming off of this from doing a lot of Apple stuff too. So you have a good sense of how Apple and Google are doing and how they compare to each other.
Yeah, I mean, that came up a lot sort of during the conversations around the event. You know, people were comparing the Google event to the way Apple sort of handles things, sort of critiquing one versus the other. And I mean, this is a developer show. For people who aren't aware, Google I.O. is a developer-focused show. There is, like, that beginning keynote where they sort of really high-level go through basically everything that they've been working on. And everything really feels like everything this time. But after that, like, this is a show meant for people who are getting down into the weeds and building apps and figuring out how best to create and deploy and manage their own software. So we were left with a very palpable sense sort of halfway through that this was very interesting but kind of pie in the sky, maybe even slightly boring stuff to some people. It's just easy to forget. That's what I.O. was kind of always like. They, you know, there's smart home platform improvements, there's Wear stuff, there's Assistant, there's quantum computing, but then also the more traditional stuff that you'd associate with Google. So Android, for example.
So very different than like an Apple media event, right? Which I think is very, almost very commercial-like and very slick in a way. This is a little more dev focused. I'll tell you guys, I've been watching a lot of upfronts, which are the things media companies do. So like Disney and Warner Media, it's the things they create to woo advertisers and to, you know, let all their partners know what they're up to. This felt more like an upfront. It was more like, hey, we're Google. Look at everything we're doing, because it's not strictly consumer. It didn't feel exactly developer focused either in a way, because when I think developer focused and boring, I think of like Microsoft's Build keynotes, which last over 2 hours and
those
people
are
coding on stage.
There's actual, you know, coding, like, on stage. Yes.
Coding on stage. Like, that is for developers. This felt like it was labor. They were moving from bit to bit. They just had a lot of little bits to do. But let's talk about some of the high level stuff. What is changing with Android? It seems like they're finally going for a little bit more style, although I don't know. That seems debatable.
It does seem like the biggest visual refresh in, I want to say years. I believe personally since like Android 10 or maybe even before. But VU, I mean, you followed Android a little more closely than I have.
When did material design drop? Like, when was that idea?
What was that, like 2013, 14? Back when Matias Duarte really started talking about it.
Yeah.
And it really just seems like they've taken the material kind of concept and just blown it open. For people who didn't sort of see the show unfold, one of the big changes to Android 12 is the sort of, they've reshifted material design to this concept called Material U, which basically kind of builds off of their approach to sort of clean, layered design, but sort of added some really heavy customization effects. So once you set your wallpaper, for example, Android will be able to not just see what it is and sort of tune system colors appropriately, you know, they'll look for sort of complementary colors or sort of what would look so like there are, and it does also seem like those changes sort of get tied to your Google account. So if you have a Pixel and you've, you know, tricked it out just the way that you want it, that theming information stays with your account. So when you get a new one, you're basically left with a device that looks a lot like your old one, which I thought was actually
that's
really kind
of cool. The name, by the way, almost seems like a threat. Like when they first said it, it's like Material U, okay, which is reminds me of like one of my favorite lines from like bad 90s action movies, which is usually F me. No, F you. And it feels just like that. Material U, everybody. I don't know. Like, what do you guys think about this design? It looks, there's a lot of rounded edges, but it also seems like baby's first, you know, mobile UI in a way. Like, it does not seem, it doesn't even seem like, I don't know. What do you guys think? Tell me about that.
I've spent some time, and I think V, you have too, with the Android 12 beta, and my, you know, the write-up is already live on our site if you want to go check it out for more detailed impressions. But I don't believe we've seen the full extent of it, at least in this beta. There's more, what it is I think a more cohesive, more refined OS with it, in addition to these like visual design changes. So I'm more looking forward to that, because in some ways the Android 11 OS itself felt to me still like it was a beta. There were some things that were just inconsistent throughout, like font sizes or like the notifications shade just didn't look right. It looked like something out of a dev's toolbox or something. Meanwhile, so far the Android 12 beta looks cleaner. It looks, maybe it's just like my eyes adjusting to the difference, probably. But
it's a little flatter in a way. Like the way it looks, it almost looks like the way some companies do digital signage or something. Yeah. Like it is very like bold colors, round designs, big fonts, which it is more cohesive and almost flat in a way that like Windows Phone kind of was. Like the it's kind of blocky and it's not square, it's not like sharp angles.
Yeah, it's
like
rounder
that, but
for sure
it's rounder. I don't know, I see the thing. It almost seems like the interface from like a movie like Her, you know, like a sci-fi movie interface, but it does seem simplified in a way which I'm not sure part is better. It's just different.
Part of it, in my opinion, one thing I noticed is that like the new notifications shade compared to Android 11, it, like the individual cards for each alert, the color isn't as contrasty as the background it's on anymore. So it's not as different. It's actually like a lighter shade of white on top of a, like a more translucent white or something. But that makes everything feel like less, like there's so many different pieces flying around. So it's like less cluttered looking. I think that's part of the change here.
It's sort of like somebody went to, it's like when you hire an interior designer, right? You think you have a good design in your home and then you hire somebody to be like, put everything in cute little boxes and nothing gets out of its space. It's very Marie Kondo of Android. Not even, like she's all about removing things, but hey, it is kind of like that. By the way, listeners, if you want to see an example of this thing in action, check out Shrilin's piece about this Android 12 beta. But also, if you check out this live stream, she has been holding up the phone and doing cool stuff. So check that
and
out.
And there's a video coming. Stay tuned. There's a video coming.
That's all good. Is there anything, like, what else is coming to Android? Because they keep saying this is the biggest operating system in the world. You know, they're really flexing their power. What else do we have to look forward to besides Material U?
I mean, V, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that the one thing I was really hoping would wind up in this first sort of public beta build that I don't think is there, I haven't found it at least, is the sort of privacy dashboard.
Yeah, me
so
too.
It builds off of Google's idea of digital well-being to the point where, you know, some of the visuals from what we understand, look the same. There's like the circular graph that just shows you your breakdown between, you know, in this case with the privacy dashboard, how frequently some apps require access to certain permissions. And that is, to me, a very powerful thing, right? Because I think everyone, because of the way apps will just sort of claim access to whatever you allow them to, even if you're aware of it or not, you know, because people are just sort of willing generally to hit, yes, I accept, and just kind of go about their mm-hmm. lives. Like, these apps are accessing, they can access your camera, your cellular data, your identifiers, all of these things that people just do not think about. So having one place where you can sort of manage and really kind of have a quick, relatively easy think about what should and should not have access to what at any given time, that's huge. Even if people don't always use it, having a tool that makes it easier for those who are inclined, which, by the way, should be everybody, that feels like a really big step forward.
Yeah. One quick question we actually got. Let me just join in here, because we got a comment from our YouTube mm-hmm. chat. And if you join us live Thursdays around 10 a.m. Eastern, you can drop us some questions too. It's from Eski Anderson, who's asking, could you talk more about low vision accessibility on Android 12? They're visually impaired and they stick to Apple because of the accessibility options. Did we hear anything about that with this version?
Some of the changes coming to Android include some accessibility improvements, and I am actually mm-hmm. trying to pull up the exact ones yet. They're not yet in the Android beta, but you know, Google has been making some updates to its accessibility features in the last few months, instead of just waiting for like an Android 12 release. For low vision, I believe you might be relying on something like a screen reader. Android or Google is at least constantly kind of working on updating that. So let me get you the exact updates. I know there are some improvements mm-hmm. coming to the Android 12 UI, unless you know offhand, V, what that might be.
I don't. I was actually just thinking, and this is, I swear to God, I'm not like an Apple booster that just like happened. Like, they just timed things out very well.
Yesterday.
We didn't hear much about specific accessibility improvements to Android 12, but I should point out Apple did, ahead of WWDC, outline a handful of really interesting accessibility features that will be part of iOS 15 and iPadOS 15. So I think it was or will be Global Accessibility Day fairly soon. So that's
yep.
kind of feels like why they did it. But at the same time, it seems pretty clear that Apple is really keen on playing this up. And Android is working on it. They just maybe weren't as sort of making it a point to have that front and center in the keynote.
The new design, by the way, like Material U does look like a design that could easily be more visually accessible because it's less cluttered and they can get bigger, right?
That's part of the thing. If you have mm-hmm. your system font set to bigger because you have low visibility, I have a friend who is legally blind and their screen is always zoomed into like 200% or something like that. That's part of what Material U is supposed to do, which is to keep the font size the same, whether you open a different app and somehow they've forgotten the built-in font mm-hmm. Command and that sort of stuff. So if you're using that sort of system UI change, that's something that Android mentioned. And also, yes, GAAD, aka Global Accessibility Awareness Day, is coming up, or actually has happened. I was like, we were thinking if we should have something tied up to that, but it felt like playing, like being, we shouldn't just kind of like have something up just because, you know, it should be constant reporting on this issue. Anyway.
Did we hear anything about Android on tablets, by the way? Because I remember that was a big deal that you were talking about some stuff, Lynn. Did they mention that at all?
So that's part of Material U. I don't think Google necessarily called out tablets specifically during I/O, but Material U is meant to kind of adapt to different screen sizes, I believe. And also, you know, echo your same chosen design preferences mm-hmm. on all your devices tied to your Google account. So your watch, for example, Wear OS is going to be committed to this whole new Material U look. And tablets should also, and foldables should also, you know, offer similar
things. Let's talk about Wear OS, by the way, because you brought mm-hmm. it up. I like to make fun of how badly Google has handled smartwatches. There's at least some big and interesting news for the next year, right?
Yeah. So huge news. Samsung and Google. Actually, Google, I don't know if they reached out or whatever, but Google and Samsung are teaming up on the next Wear OS. And because of that, Samsung is completely saying goodbye to Tizen, more or less. So not completely. It's the existing devices that run Tizen OS will continue to run it and get support for 3 years. And then every other new wearable that Samsung makes from now on will be running on this new Wear OS that the company says it co-engineered with Google. Are you hype? You should be hyped.
Hey, there were some things in Tizen that were clearly better than Android Wear, and it never made sense why the best Android, you know, the Galaxy watches were the best Android specific smartphone, smart watches around. So, and they weren't using Google's platform. So having a little more of a unified thing, I think kind of makes sense. This is Google realizing we are bad at this thing, especially when it comes to like consumer electronics and consumer UI. So let's talk to Samsung, which is the biggest consumer electronics or next to Apple, one of the biggest in the world. So makes sense. It makes a lot of sense for them to partner because it's good for Samsung. It's good for Google, right?
Sherlyn, really quick, one question that I've sort of been chewing on that I don't think I ever got a great answer to, and I'm pretty sure a few other people have this as well. You know, with the sort of confluence now between Tizen and Wear OS, are we looking at a completely different sort of software foundation for Wear OS? Like, is it part Wear OS, part Tizen? Or is Samsung really just saying here, yeah, Tizen didn't work. Let's just work with you guys on what already exists and what can exist in Wear OS?
So my understanding is, in terms of a software foundation, we're talking about two levels. We're talking about a deeper level below what the user sees, which is overall how processes are handled in the background, how you know, you can get things like constant heart rate monitoring in a way that doesn't sap your battery too much. At that level, there are changes, right? Google did say that it's expecting things like apps to launch 30% faster. You've got more animations. And I mentioned before, I don't know if on this podcast specifically, but having more animations throughout a UI, even if it's something as small as a something flashing, an element flashing when you tap it, it makes a UI feel more responsive. Just because you're not kind of just waiting for things to not happen or happen, right? So that level, yes. And then on the whole UI that's facing the watch wearer, my understanding, based on renders I've seen, it's very similar to existing Wear OS, except for the tiles feature, which Google introduced in 2019 and had it limited to just first-party widgets in the past, is going to expand to include third-party widgets way more than before. And we haven't heard a lot of other names, but we've got Calm and Spotify that seem like they're on board. And this tiles feature was always very similar to Tizen OS, where it's side-swiping, horizontal scrolling to see all your different, like, apps that you want there, and you can customize it, put your favorite ones near the center. So that's where it's very similar to Tizen. And where Tizen was limited in that style before was that it was all pretty much all Samsung's own widgets.
You had
like a Spotify widget here and there. You had an Uber widget maybe if you wanted to, maybe a MyFitnessPal for like calorie tracking or something. But it was basically mostly Samsung widgets. So now you have the option of side swiping through possibly the whole world of Android apps if Google and Samsung get their way. So that's, I think...
Yeah.
Does that answer your question, V? Do you understand better now kind of with that software change?
Yeah. No, that's hugely helpful. It also just seems like a really big deal because I think probably all of us at this point have tried some Galaxy wearable running Tizen. Like, I think I still have a Galaxy Watch S3 or like the Frontier or whatever from a while ago around here, and I did love it for what it was, but yeah, like the biggest sticking point to me at least was it'll do all of the traditional smart watch functions just fine. Like, it'll do fitness tracking to an extent, which was also very helpful, but when it came time to try and figure out other things you could do with a watch, Tizen always felt a little too limited, right? Like, as you mentioned, there are a couple companies like Spotify, like Uber, that were ride or die. Like, from the beginning, they were talking up their partnerships with Samsung for Tizen. And now we finally get maybe everybody.
Yeah.
It sounds like a huge world that we might now finally be able to access on our wrists.
Well, we're going to get a Bitmoji watch face. So.
Great.
We probably
will. That was definitely a Samsung thing, wasn't it? Have to imagine.
Even with this partnership, I have a hard time getting too excited for where OS is going, because honestly, even watchOS, even the Apple Watch is kind of limited and not going as far as I'd like. Yeah, we'll see. I guess it's better than it's ever has been for Android, right?
But it's given, exciting. Yeah. A lot of people are excited about it. I forgot. Finally. I had one thing to say about this, but I forgot. Anyway, we'll continue.
I remember like when all this stuff started and people were talking about smartwatches, and people were just so hype on the Moto 360 because it was a round face smartwatch. And those were the simple days when like Moto was like actually still doing cool stuff and they haven't just given up. I would like a return to those exciting days, but I think that was 2012, 2013. It does feel like Google consistently, they've had this platform. They fail to like really grow it. The partnership is all splintered, and maybe this will help. Maybe this will kind of unify things. Yeah.
I remember one thing I wanted to say. So one of the things that people like about Tizen and Galaxy Watches is the rotating bezel makes it so easy to just side scroll. I could see how, you know, that feature that Google seemed to abandon on Wear OS where they actually had a rotating knob that let you scroll through apps on like an apps list or like a notifications list. I could see Google bringing that back with Samsung on this new Wear OS where instead of a, or in addition maybe to the rolling, this rotating bezel that Samsung watches would have, maybe other OEMs could make this rotating knob to side scroll through widgets too. It might make it easier if you have a lot of apps stacked up sideways. Anyway, this is me kind of just guessing and maybe trying to give Google some ideas if they want to give me some credit for this eventually.
I'm sure they will definitely give you credit. Absolutely.
But get in for those royalties.
Really quick on that accessibility question, by the way, Dev, that you pointed out, I just wanted to just quickly answer that. So in the Material U announcement post, there is a section on accessibility about Material U design. So it's like supposedly the section is called Accessible for Every Need. And like I mentioned, like it's not just the size of the font, but also it allows you to have control of contrast and line width with a contextually aware system that can customize UIs in more ways than previously possible. So there might be other things that you can adjust to make it easier to read the screen or elements on the screen.
Awesome. Material U, guys. Just Material U.
Which is going to be part of the new look on Wear OS too. Just to tie it back to what we were talking about.
Material U. I just can't. I can't get over saying it. Let's move over to some other bits. There are other interesting things. I think they mentioned. I wrote up a story about Google basically working with a group of diverse experts, black and brown experts in the tech field and in cinematography. They're working on building a more racially inclusive Android camera. So they're actually getting a lot of feedback in from these folks about, you know, how lighting works and how to deal with auto white balance and auto color balance and exposure levels and things like that. So that, you know, these future Pixel phones are better at interpreting how light bounces off darker skin. And I think that is going to be a big deal for a lot of users. Honestly, like, I'll tell you guys, like, smartphone cameras don't do well with my skin tone. And I'm not, you know, I'm a little dark too, guys. So it is like, this seems like stuff that is a long time coming. I'm glad to see Google is doing it. It also feels like some of this has been happening already. So I don't know, Sherlyn, do you have a sense of like how different is this from the way Android cameras has been you know, have been working so far?
So Google has been talking up this whole like we're looking into making sure cameras are aware or you know compensating or you know just evaluating for different skin tones. First I heard of it that I remember anyway was during a briefing for Google's new Meet hardware. It was releasing you know video cameras or webcams for conference calls and that sort of thing. And even in, as early as that, they were talking about how they were looking at how a camera interprets or their photography algorithms interpret different skin tones. It's been a while. And I know that I believe around the time when Google was talking about how you can use Android phones, webcams to measure your heart rate, something like that, Google might also have talked a little bit, sort of like teased that they're looking at improving camera software to understand different skin tones as well. So they've sort of hinted at this, but this is a big commitment. And what? Good for you, Google. I think this is so important.
It's good. I mean, it's important for people to realize, too, cameras are more about than just the lenses or the sensors they're putting into things, especially for smartphones. Cameras these days are also heavily reliant on software. Google, you know, Google's portrait modes, you know, has been an entirely software thing before cameras, multiple cameras started heading into smartphones. So, V, did you want to add anything here?
I was just going to, I've been thinking to myself about all of this. You know, this does sound really cool. And, you know, they did go a bit into sort of how they're doing this, right? Like they're making sure more pictures of black people are winding up in the data sets that they're using to train the algorithms. They've sort of enlisted the help of these black creators who can just sort of more ably kind of give Google a sense of how, like, what conditions black skin looks good in. Like, I got a very sort of like Issa Rae vibe there.
Oh, yeah, because of it, Insecure.
Insecure lit black people beautifully. And, you know, that's unfortunately relatively rare. I am a little concerned, though. Like, we have seen really, really cool announcements and just sort of software features announced at Google I.O. that just take quite a while to trickle out. The one that immediately springs to mind is I don't know if you remember a couple years ago, there was this one Google Assistant demo where everything was just moving lightning fast. Was happening on device. They had shrunk down the machine learning model to function really beautifully on a phone. And to my knowledge, you correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like that hasn't made it out to any Android device yet. So again, I wonder if this is one of those situations where Google clearly is moving in the right direction, but doesn't really have anything to show for it for a while.
Well, so they mentioned that we will probably see something on Pixel phones this fall or soon. And I think the other interesting thing is Google said whatever they learn, they're going to be sharing with the rest of the Android community. So this will probably first appear in like the Pixel camera or the Google camera. What is that? Is it a specific app that's on Pixel phones now? But it will probably be within that and then hopefully on other Android devices eventually.
Given Google's ability to kind of just push out Night Sight as quickly like as it did after first announcing Night Sight, and I don't think this is exactly the same technology, but in the same kind of realm, I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see this roll out with the next Pixel phone, maybe the Pixel 6, not the 5A, probably not, but maybe the Pixel 6.
Maybe something cool. There was also, they showed off something that I think nobody expected, which is called Project Starline. Can you tell me a bit about that, Sherlyn?
Project Starline is this, I believe Sundar Pichai also called it a moonshot. This is video conferencing at the next level. This is when you make a meet call with your friend in the future with Project Starline technology, which is, by the way, not going to come out anytime soon. Yeah. It uses light field technology, so specialized cameras to kind of detect you, the caller, and then your features in 3D, and then also project that to the person you're calling so that when you see each other and you're talking to each other on this call, you both look like you're actually sort of there, you're in 3D, your features, your facial features, and the depth of your person can be viewed, of course, through a specialized display, like almost a holographic looking glass style display.
Well, let me just say, they're set up for this thing. The way they demoed it, right, is that you step into a booth. It looks like a diner booth, right, where you step in. You're in front of this giant screen, this window. There's a 3D depth sensing camera that takes your image and, you know, compresses that, shoots it to another one of these booths somewhere else. And then on the other side is a giant display. It's not just like a small screen. Yeah, it is like, you know, it is like life size. It looks like a bathroom vanity mirror, basically, where you see a lifelike 3D version of the person you're talking to. I'm sure they couldn't convey it super well. There is a video out there that Google is showing off. You could still see some compression. You could see some like, you know, issues around the edges, but I'm sure in person, seeing the actual 3D depth would make it seem even more exciting or interesting, right?
Oh yeah. I now that you've kind of broken it down, I'm also concerned about like how, you know, what sort of internet speeds and bandwidth are we talking? Because this is like I said, that Pichai said, probably a moonshot because it's going to rely heavily on our favorite topic, 5G. It's going to rely very heavily on, you know, very good data speed.
I will say there were Google people. I think some of the folks working on this were geeking around on Twitter. And John Carmack, the co-founder of id Software, you know, the formal CTO of Oculus, was also geeking out about this. And Google people confirmed to him that it does not need crazy internet. It could probably, they said like 10 megabits per second, which is, you know, kind of the standard for 4K video.
No kidding.
So yeah, they're saying it doesn't take that much, but I'm sure this overall hardware setup, you can't just replicate this anywhere, but I could see this being the sort of thing that pops up in like offices or something down the line where they have phone booths and you actually want to have a face-to-face conversation with somebody. This is a way to do it that's better than a webcam, at least.
Given we're all remote working, we're all kind of, I think, going back to maybe some sort of hybrid environment for a bit. This is very interesting. V, what do you think?
I would love to put one of these in my basement. God darn it.
You want to put everything
perfect for it. This is also true, but that's maybe a story for another time. But yeah, like it really does seem like the limiting factor here is the hardware. Google mentioned that they're using high resolution cameras and depth sensors to kind of develop the 3D model of you that appears in this volumetric sort of looking glass style display. And, you know, as exciting as it is, the possibility to maybe just like go to work one day and jump in on a meeting with one of these, like that's not really when I want to use this, right? Like if I want to feel like I'm really talking to someone, it's going to be my dad who lives like an hour or two away and like I can't rent a car and visit all of the time. Like those are the kinds of people I really want to feel like I'm in front of And it unfortunately does kind of seem like it'll be a while, if ever, before we get to have that experience in our homes.
Yeah. Speaking of moonshots, by the way, Google also showed off something called Lambda AI, which is a sort of like, I don't know, a smarter way of having natural conversations with Google Assistant and AIs. What can you guys break this down for me? Like, what was going on here? Because they were talking to Pluto, which was confusing.
V, you can go ahead.
Let me take this one. So as I understand it, Lambda is a sort of a machine learning framework that goes, to put it sort of pretty simply, very broadly and very deeply with respect to concepts. And Pluto is a really interesting example. Like, in order for this machine learning algorithm to sort of act as though it is the planet Pluto and sort of engaging mm-hmm. with it from that perspective, it not only has to understand what Pluto is, but it sort of has to understand related concepts. So space exploration, weather, just sort of the mechanics of the solar system, gravity. So it sort of goes out to sort of build a net of things that it should know about as they relate to Pluto. But then it also goes quite deep in those concepts as well. So it's maybe not the best explanation, but Google is really doing – it's like wild to see.
It's like they're trying to give an existential justification for why this AI exists. And I do feel like this is how you get Skynet, folks. This is how you get, you know, AI that just it loses its sense of persona and doesn't know – the difference between right and wrong. It thinks, I am Earth, therefore I must protect Earth, therefore I must destroy all of humanity.
I remember similar concerns being thrown around the first time we saw Google mm-hmm. unveil Duplex at an I.O. in years past. And yeah. Duplex, as a recap,
it was like Google's basic back and forth conversation. Yeah,
yeah, it's similar mm-hmm. to this where it's AI technology where the assistant was able to like insert pauses that indicated hesitation during mm-hmm. a conversation with a restaurant on the phone, and people were like, oh my gosh, this is too real. This is what, you know, and Lambda also has similar, you know, that sort of similar feeling to it. It feels like it's trying to build up assistant to be almost a very, very human bot. And understandably, people are concerned. Yeah.
It's like a kid's game, right? Where you ask a kid to pretend you are this thing, and then it starts to act as if it is that thing. I don't know, guys. Maybe we should not give our AI this existential awareness just yet until we can control our AI.
That is why people are looking into AI ethics and law and how to kind of regulate all of that or to make sure that doesn't go buck wild.
That hasn't gone so well for Google lately.
We will discuss in future episodes because I have a family member who is deeply investigating some of these things, so we can talk.
AI ethics is a big thing. Google... Oh, yeah. For the past couple of months, has historically showed that it has done a bad job of managing its AI ethics department. So we've talked a bit about that. Google that stuff. Yeah. I cannot trust Google when it comes to AI stuff right now, unfortunately. One other thing I think is worth calling out is Smart Canvas, which is something basically the next evolution of Google Workplace or like all the, you know, all the Google online office software. It's basically a way to like unify the way all of its different apps work. So they showed us some examples, like in a Google Doc, you could basically pipe in one of your meetings. So you can talk with people as you're working with a doc right alongside it. Right now, you can start a Google meeting, you know, and manually say, hey, I'm going to broadcast this document to you, which is kind of clunky. It's not super smooth. They're basically creating different ways to like tag people. So like in a document, if you want to say, Sherlyn, you're going to be dealing with this part of the podcast, I can tag Sherlyn to it and it'll become part of her tasks. You can link to other Google documents or you could like seamlessly link into Sheets. You can, within Google Chats, which is their workplace chat thing, you can immediately just hop into like a sheet to edit data. So it is a more seamless, unified way of dealing with all of these office documents. Not the sort of thing consumers will probably see soon, but I think for professionals and especially people who live in the Google Docs ecosystem, it seems like a big deal, at least to me. I don't know about you guys.
It's very, very similar to what Microsoft mm-hmm. just unveiled last build mm-hmm. with the, I forget what they call their thing.
Fluid Framework. They showed off Fluid Framework. But we're still only seeing little bits of that. But yeah, it is a similar thing of like saying, hey, we're kind of going to unify all of our apps.
Yeah.
The idea of a single document may matter less because everything is interconnected, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Dev, just for my own clarification, because as I recall, this was like the first major product announcement of the keynote. And I think at that point during the stream, I was still like, Okay, yeah. What's going on here?
What is here?
So what's the best way to think about this thing? Is it really just sort of a fabric that unites all of Google's sort of existing mm-hmm. productivity services? Or is it something more than that?
I think it's pretty much that. Like, it is not a separate mm-hmm. product. It is like, think of it like the next evolution of Google Docs, you know, and Google Sheets and Google Slides. Young folks may not remember a world before having, you know, decent online web apps to collaborate mm-hmm. on work, but that was certainly the case. And I think Google Docs landed in, like, what, 2006? You know, shortly after Gmail arrived. And, hey, I was working in IT. I had to help support how people, you know, collaborated on files and worked on documents and stuff. And it was like, this was a game changer, because all of a sudden, you didn't just have to, like, share, you know, have a Microsoft Word document, share it on your computer, email it to somebody, have them hopefully do the track changes, have them mail it back to you. Like, it really streamlined the whole process of working on documents together. And then Google Docs, yeah, allowed for people to work simultaneously on a single document. So on a sheet, you know, on a spreadsheet or on a, you know, on a presentation slide. That was just game changing. And it kind of spurred on everybody, including Microsoft, to build better web apps. So now you can do Microsoft Word on the web with Office 365. I don't think it's as seamless. It's not as it's not the sort of thing everybody has. And then Office 365 is a subscription tools. Like, you have to pay to use that stuff, whereas Google Drive, all the Google stuff is free. So I think Google has fundamentally reshaped the way a lot of people work, especially students. And this is just the next step.
I totally agree. I remember when I was like, I will be dead before I give up my Office software. And then here mm-hmm. I am now. I refuse to work on Office. Oh, yeah. No. When Google
are you
first...
You're Lynn being stubborn about useless things? Yes.
Thanks.
What else is new?
Podcast.
What else is new?
Yeah, but of all the things to sort of raise a stink over, really?
Well, that's before I was a Google girl. This was when I had Gmail. I had everything. I was like, no.
You'll take my Office keys... from my cold, dead fingers.
Word is so much more useful. Sheets are so limited.
Hotmail for life.
Yeah.
Hotmail for life.
Just Office for life. Yeah. Then now I'm like, Google all the time. Just screw it.
Google
like,
all the time.
You sent me a dot doc? What the hell even is that?
What the hell is this? You know, it is hard to fathom, I think, for especially younger folks. Like, this stuff really changed the way we work. I used to have to, we had to deal with like email apps to read our email, you know, in the past, or deal with really, really bad web email apps, which were built on CGI and like refreshed manually. And they were so bad.
Oh, good Lord.
Wow.
Yeah. That was what things were like before Gmail and before Google Docs and everything. So, hey, we're talking about the past. This seems really interesting. I wonder if people will actually latch onto it, because we are a Google workplace over in Gadget, so hopefully more of these we'll take advantage of some of these features. Is there anything else you guys want to add about Google I/O?
We will be playing with all of these things they were announced, so stay tuned to Engadget for our coverage as it rolls out. So,
and yes, we are still like I/O as we're recording this is still happening. There's still sessions, there's still news coming out of these things, so stay tuned for a lot more.
Let's move on to our reviews of the latest Apple products. V, you just saw and reviewed the iPad Pro with the M1 processor. Clearly, this is the best device Apple has ever produced, right? Right? That seems like the hype here.
That's kind of what I'm feeling. And I feel weird even like being this enthusiastic about a thing, because like it's on one hand, it is very definitively still just an iPad. Mm-hmm. Like the software, which is a whole other story unto itself. Like I have the very strong impression that Apple's going to do some crazy stuff at WWDC mm-hmm. that will allow developers and Apple itself to really kind of take this hardware to the next level. But it's not there yet. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it has the best screen I've ever seen basically in a tablet. It has desktop-grade performance. It has 5G. Like, if you had to ask me what was Apple's best personal computer, like their best all-in-one personal computing package, one could make a pretty strong argument that this is it. And that's frankly kind of insane.
Well, let me just say, I was being a little facetious, because I'm not going to say this is Apple's best product, because a good product has to have both great hardware and great software. And as you just said, and as is the title of your review, this device makes it really clear that Apple's hardware has kind of outpaced at least where the iPad OS is and where its mobile software is. To me, that feels limiting, right? Because this thing is as expensive as a MacBook Air and a MacBook Pro. If you go up to the big price, it is heavier than a MacBook Pro when you add on the new keyboard, which is wild to me. And yet it is less capable, right? Because it can only run the iPadOS apps. It is very limited in terms of how you can multitask and do things. It is a vision into the future, but it also seems like not fully equipped to replace somebody's MacBook Pro. Somebody who needs a MacBook Pro would still, you couldn't just move over to the iPad Pro entirely, right?
Like, maybe. And here's where uh-huh. here's where like the cognitive dissonance comes into play. Like, I've been reviewing iPad Pros for a long time. Mm-hmm. And for basically the entirety of the time that they've existed, they're basically just bigger iPads.
Yes.
They've relied on the software to sort of define what that experience
and
means.
And better screens. Like, they had high refresh rate screens before anything else. Yeah, on iPad.
Very true.
Yeah.
So they specifically chose areas of focus where they knew they could sort of push the envelope a bit and, you know, kind of pick up steam for future endeavors. But I have also sort of come to the realization over the last few years I've reviewed these things that, like, maybe the way that we work on a computer, like, at this point in my life, I would strongly prefer to use a laptop more than basically any other kind of computer.
Depends on the work, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but like, I don't know about you. My workflow is generally like Photoshop, photo editing, mm-hmm. a lot of web browsing, a lot of writing. I'll maybe record, you know, a podcast or like another thing that I'm working on. Like, that's like 85 to 90% of like my daily use case. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stuff you can do on an iPad. So I wonder if there's just like a generational shift at play where people like us who mm-hmm. have come up on traditional PCs, on laptops, have turned to laptops as our main mode of portable computing. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're just in for a shift. Like, maybe we are officially last generation and people really can kind of fit their lives into an iPad. I know it's mm-hmm. weird to talk about.
It is weird. Yeah.
I feel like there are quite a few people out there who could probably make this work without too much trouble.
I've talked to a lot of people about that. And honestly, I'm thinking of like eventually getting an iPad Pro, maybe not this model, but maybe last year's at a discount, which, hey, by the way, folks, that is the best way to get hardware. Get it refurbished, get the last model, get it cheaper. But I want that high refresh rate screen. I want like a nice portable writing machine and something to just write on and it consume a bit of media. Sure. It won't replace my desktop. I have a huge desktop PC here for gaming and for doing podcast production because I got to sometimes edit things. Sometimes I do a little bit of video editing. Like, there's stuff I need to do. You can do it on the iPad. It's just not ideal. I do agree there is probably a generational shift here. My main question for you, V, like, do you feel a real difference with this iPad Pro compared to last year's, which was also really fast? We said the same exact thing, actually, where this is some of the best hardware around, but the software just isn't there yet. That wasn't an M1 chip, but it was still really fast. Can you actually feel the difference this year?
Basically, no.
Yeah.
But again, that boils down to like my use case. It's like, by far, the one thing I use any computer for more than anything is just like trying to write because I'm not great at it.
Sure.
And I just have to like bash my head against the keyboard until something of value comes out. I will say, though, I never got the impression that I was ever using the M1 to its fullest. And again, that's a software thing. Mm-hmm. Like, developers simply have not had the time required to optimize their apps and sort of build in sort of the forward-thinking features to kind of make these experiences distinct. Mm-hmm. LumaFusion is a great example. It's probably the premier video editing app on iPad right now. And it does work really well. I was exporting 4K videos, you know, everything like adding transitions and sort of doing the basics of video editing work felt really, really fast. Mm-hmm. Like, I had no complaints there. But when it comes to export, for example, any video editor will tell you that like exporting is like the part where you cross your fingers and like pray that everything works out okay.
And you walk away from your computer because you can't do anything else. Yeah.
Exactly. It's, you know, I've rendered stuff on my like actual personal PC that's taken like 40 minutes. I'm like, all right, cool. I'm going to make lunch. Bye. Mm-hmm. But compared to last year's iPad Pro, which used the A12Z chipset, this year's iPad Pro was maybe 30 seconds faster, maybe.
30 seconds. Oh, on the Encode? Yeah.
On the Encode, yeah. And, you know, switching into Premiere Rush, which is, you know, a very different kind of editing app, but one that's sort of available cross-platform, so it's nice to try. The difference was a little bit more palpable there, but even then, not by much.
Is the screen any different, by the way? Like, because this has mini LEDs, right? And it's still, so last year's was high refresh rate. Last year's was still really bright. But the bezels and stuff are the same. It's just mini LED this year. So that must be noticeable, right?
It is some of the time.
What?
Again. Well, hang on. When you're doing that stuff that we do, which is like writing a lot and recording and like web browsing and like researching, you will not tell the difference. The max brightness in those situations is 600 nits. So exactly like what it was on last year's iPad.
Which is really bright. 600 nits is bright, surprisingly bright for a mobile device.
You're doing fine. Like, this is totally usable outdoors. Mm-hmm. But when things really get crazy, when you actually start to watch videos or play games, especially with HDR content, at that point, the max full screen brightness jumps up to 1,000 nits. And there are, you know, if you've got HDR content going, like those really bright, you know, portions, those can hit 1,600. So long story short, the stuff that's bright gets really bright. Good. And the stuff that is supposed to be dark stays dark. Or, you know, dark enough
because of mini LEDs. Yeah.
Because of mini LED, because of all these localized dimming zones, because of like the 10,000 tiny LEDs that they had to develop precision machinery to place on the back plane of this display. Mm-hmm. When you're watching videos, it is night and day better than what we had before.
That's interesting.
But for anything else, you're not going to see a whole lot.
My, Sherlyn, do you want to jump in here with any questions?
Do you watch a lot of video on your iPad? Because I watch video on my TV.
I watch YouTube constantly.
On an iPad?
I'm just like on the couch in my bed. Like, I have a TV that's decently nice, and I only use it when I'm like playing PS5 or like having dinner and I want to watch The West Wing so I feel less alone. Every other time I'm on a phone or a tablet or something. So yeah, in those cases, it does kind of feel like the iPad has sort of taken over as the capital B capital D best display in my home.
How about this though? Why not just put Mac OS on it? It is running the Mac hardware. It's literally running the M1 chip now. Like it has there's a keyboard accessory. They can optimize it for a touchscreen. Why, you know, do you think that's something Apple would ever do? Would that make this a better machine?
It might make it it wouldn't necessarily make it a better machine. Right. It makes it a different machine. And Devendra, you raised an interesting point earlier where like you might buy an iPad Pro someday but you would only ever use it as a supplemental.
It would never
device,
be my
right?
only computer. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Apple, I think for a long time they thought maybe this is where everything is really at and this is what we focus on. Tim Cook has said in his own words, the iPad was Apple's vision for the future of computing. And now, especially with the pandemic sort of driving Mac sales up, like Mac sales have been through the roof, especially in last quarter's earnings, it's become pretty clear to Apple that at least for now, there are people who could feasibly move full-time into an iPad Pro, but that's not what's happening on a market level. People are buying a lot of iPads, but they're also buying a lot of Macs. Mm-hmm. So with that sort of very keen understanding of the situation, I don't think Apple, at this point, for the next few years at least, is going to say, hey, you know what? Let's just put Mac OS on an iPad.
Yeah,
let's
that's
just
never
blur
gonna
the line
that's
entirely.
That's never going to happen. That was old Apple. That was 2005 Apple when they did the Intel transition. They were like, hey, you could put Windows on this, sort of. By the way, weird thing. I was writing up, I'll talk about this later, but I wrote up like, you know, a story about how Sony is kind of faltering where it is now. I didn't realize, I forgot the news that, Steve Jobs initially pitched Sony to run Mac OS in like 2000. So
who wouldn't like Sony
on Sony via
I feel like
computers.
At the time?
Yeah.
Vios were like the
Vios were the hot
best. Oh, yeah. They're so beautiful,
man.
So beautiful. R.I.P. Hey, there's
also the brand
we're still getting
exists.
News from a company called Bio. It's just not Sony. It's just not Sony. Anyway, so the iPad Pro sounds exciting. That is the sort of thing where I'm like, if I'm not paying for like baby stuff and saving money and, you know, dealing with house repairs and whatnot, that would be like a nice little light writing machine I'd like to invest in. But it does not make sense for me to go for this new one when the last year's iPad Pro will probably get cheaper and will be a really good deal. So there's that. But what if you could get a Mac that doesn't, you know, that stays in one place, that lets you do a lot of work all at
it
once?
It comes in cool colors.
Yeah. How about Mac U or iMac?
Oh, God.
No.
Mac U.
Mac that U. one back in the drawer.
iMac. Devendra, I reviewed the iMac M1, which was a lot of fun because I've tested out iMacs before. I've played with them. This thing just feels so different than any other iMacs, right? It has the same basic design. It is a giant display on a small little pedestal foot, but it is so thin. It's like 11 to 12 millimeters thin throughout the entire device. So It is just like a flat, super flat object. There is no hump like the older IMAX. And it's really light too. It's under 10 pounds. So it's like 9.8 pounds, which sounds heavy compared to laptops and stuff. Sure. I know a lot of people who have IMAX who always move them around their house, like especially during pandemic times, right? Like you're moving around to do video chats in different places. Sometimes I see people doing it if they're on broadcast or something or on a podcast, they'll move their computer to a different room. This computer is basically the first portable desktop I've ever seen because I was just so tempted to like put it in my kitchen. You know, I brought it upstairs, put it in my kitchen, and I talked to some folks at Apple. They're like, yeah, that, I have it there for cooking videos and to pull up recipes because it's easier than having just an iPad propped up. It is a bigger screen. It's a 24-inch screen. The screen looks amazing. It's the M1 chip, so it's super fast. I brought it up to my wife's office to do some writing upstairs just because I like the natural light there better. It is really cool. Are you guys excited by this? It's colorful, which is nice too. Yeah,
I think we've seen all-in-ones with handles in the past, by the way. Like, way back
sure,
in the day
with when handles, Sherlyn, because they're heavy. because they're heavy,
yes. There was also, and I don't know the weights of all the all-in-ones in the world. You obviously have, like, white
screens
there.
So the old iMac 21.5-inch was closer to 20 pounds. That thing was, like,
that's
19
crazy.
Pounds.
Yeah.
So,
ooh,
yeah.
That's insane. And there are some all-in-ones designed for use in places like kitchens and living rooms too. Just FYI. But I mean, not to say that like you're wrong in calling this like a very lightweight iMac or all-in-one. But I'm more curious, Dev. When we first saw the announcement for these iMacs, one of people's biggest issues was that chin. Did that bother you at all during your testing?
So I don't like the chin. Yeah, it's not the best thing in the world. I'm all about super thin bezels. This is why we love Dell's XPS lineup so much. They did slim down the bezels around the sides and the top. The chin is actually there. Now that I've tested it, this thing has 6 speakers and like force-canceling woofers and things like that. Like there's a huge speaker array. So it actually sounds really good. So it makes music sound really good. It makes movies sound really good. It's Atmos capable. So you can watch, like, get some simulated 3D sound and stuff. It is like a capable little sound machine. So that is why that space is there. You cannot have good sound without dedicating some space to it. Unfortunately, that's just physics. So once we see the teardowns, I'm pretty sure we'll see, like, a lot of that space is just taken up with speakers. So I would like to see less chin, but until they, like, come up with other ways to bring in good sound and for a machine like this, you probably don't want to have external speakers. You know, you want like a nice, clean setup. I would rather have this. So it didn't really bother me after seeing it for a while. Yeah.
Dev, are you concerned at all? You know, you spec this thing out when you buy it. You get it, you use it for however long you use it. But as far as we're aware, there's no upgradability here at all, right?
I mean, the old iMacs, like back in the pre-2010 era, sure, you could upgrade. You could add a little more RAM. You could do some stuff. That was always fun. But no, there's no upgrading here. I mean, these things are all, you know, it is what it is right now. We are buying self-contained devices that cannot be upgraded. If you care about upgradability, don't buy an all-in-one. You know, at that point, even consider a Mac Mini because can you open up a Mac Mini? I haven't actually tested that. Yeah. So Mac Minis are great options, you know, especially if you want the M1 chip and you want to pay a little less and then you can have your choice of monitor. This is just a good like, hey, we're a family. We want to buy a computer that sits in a central spot that everybody can use. Kids can use it for homework. You know, different parents can log onto it with the new Touch ID sensor on the keyboard really easily. It is like the ideal family computer. And it's also like if you have young kids and they don't have their own laptops because kids shouldn't have laptops until, you know, they're a little older. This is like a good machine to have to like set up in the living room to let them do their work or the kitchen table or something. Like I think for a lot of people, this is kind of like a good family work machine and also directly opposed to whatever the iPad Pro is doing, right? In terms of the future of work, sometimes the old ways are better, I think. Like this is kind of showing that, yeah.
I mean, speaking of old ways, pre-2010 era and what you said about speakers, I just want to say that I remember a little nostalgically back in the day when I was using computers where they came with like a pair of speakers you plug in and then you can control
like,
the volume dial.
A pair of like plastic garbage speakers.
Oh, yeah. Really like a echo looking thing.
Were those the days for you?
Those beige beauties.
Yeah, those beige or black sometimes. So
beige.
That's all my, like,
oh man.
Yeah. And then my computer screen was freaking thick as F. But yes.
Yep. Let me just say a few other things here. I like the idea that they brought back color, because I also think the iMac kind of strayed away from what it was trying to do originally with the original, like, big old CRT iMacs, right? Those things were colorful and cute, and they made computers friendly for people, because back then, PCs were these ugly gray boxes, you know? Gateway was kind of different for putting them in white boxes. And then there was Sony that was doing dark boxes, and that was, like, the extent of PC design. Apple introduced color into the fray, and they went away with that, I think, maybe because they started going down the Johnny Ive, like, got to get your brushed aluminum, got to get your, you know, your cool colors. What is this thing? His chamfered edges. It really, everything started to look really monotone and gray. And this color is just like a pop of life. I got the orange one, which just, it looks kind of creamsicle from the front. It's just really cute and approachable. I really like it. I do not like Apple's keyboards and mice. This is just a reminder. Mm. The Magic Keyboard sucks. The Magic Mouse is awful, but the trackpad is actually really good. So I would actually recommend a lot of people, if you don't like the feeling of the Magic Mouse, put on another mouse or get the Magic Trackpad, which is a nice big touchpad. It just feels really good. Yeah. Any other questions, guys? Like, there are some downsides I'll get to soon.
Wait, Dev, what's your beef with the Magic Keyboard?
It's I don't like the way it feels. I just don't like the way it, there's not enough key depth. You know, mm-hmm. It is a little small and cramped. So I noticed, like, I had to, like, hold my hands together like a little, like an ant to type. And I'm like, this mm-hmm. is no way mm-hmm. to live. I'm not going to live like this. But I'm also spoiled, because normally I use, like, nice yeah. spread out ergonomic keyboards on my PC. So that feels good. But even compared to, like, the laptop keyboards, I feel like for a laptop, I center myself a little more. Whereas on a big screen, I kind of want more space for my hands to, like, stick, mm-hmm. you know, spread out. So it's a weird balance for me. But hey, you could plug in any other devices you want to these things. A couple of downsides. We have fewer ports than before. So it's only at most 4 USB-C ports. 2 of them are Thunderbolt 2. If you buy the entry level model, it's only 2 USB-C ports, which kind of sucks. There's Ethernet on the power brick of the more expensive model, but not on the cheaper one. You could buy that separately. And these things are expensive. You know, like, it starts at what? I gotta look it up, like $12 or $13.99. But once you start adding more RAM, like going from 8 gigabytes of RAM to 16 gigabytes is another $200. If you want to add even more storage, that is, like, that creeps up really quickly. So this is not an inexpensive computer. But I do think for families that want, like, a thing for everybody to work around, especially if you want to start trying to move to the iPad Pro Life or something on your own, and you still want to have a nice big machine around to do some, like, serious PC productivity work, something like this makes a lot of sense. Do you guys have any other questions about the iMac?
Should I buy one?
I don't know.
Should I just go for it?
You buy one? You will probably buy one, because you make terrible purchasing
decisions. You buy everything, exactly.
So, yes. You're like, I'm about to move. Yes.
What don't you buy?
Box. I need another big box.
Well, yeah. Well, it's very portable, though. And I was thinking of maybe getting a Surface laptop because of that screen. But maybe having a bigger screen that doesn't move anywhere mm-hmm. or doesn't have to move anywhere could be good.
Anyway.
This is all for me. This is extremely
all for me. Hey, V, I have a suggestion. Yeah. Anytime you want to buy something, you just send that money to me. And put it in an investment account for you.
No, thanks. But I do owe you a cake.
Be sure to check out our reviews of the iPad Pro and the iMac, and check out our video reviews too, because you get to see these things in action. And this was the first review I got to shoot in my house, which was kind of nice. And, you know, it was fun. It was good to put the iMac in different places. Let's move on to some other news. And boy, yeah, again, this has been a super busy week. Ford finally announced and showed off their electric F-150 Lightning pickup truck. And just have to say, this thing looks beautiful. It looks like an F-150, but it has 563 horsepower. It has a pretty, I believe, over 300 mile range on the extended battery, 775 pounds of torque, the most of any F-150 ever. But best of all, this thing costs under $40,000. And that is even before the tax credits, which could bring the price down to, like, around $33,000 for many people. This is a big freaking deal. Even if you don't care about pickup trucks and big trucks like this, the F-150 is the most popular car in America. I believe Ford ships around, like, 1 million new ones every year. So this is a big deal for people who aren't into Teslas, but for people who demand the kind of the power side of electric cars, because electric cars can be so fast and offer so much torque, this thing is super powerful. Since it has no engine, because it's just a computer on wheels, the front, where there is normally a giant engine, is just a giant trunk. So the frunk is huge. Apparently can hold like two mid-sized, what do you call
bodies?
It? Suitcases. Okay. Plus other stuff. So it's like, the thing about pickup trucks is that they're not really convenient for like getting the groceries, because if you stick them in the back, they're going around everywhere. It's hard to like keep things in place. The frunk is good for like ease of reach and manageability and stuff, but you still have the power of a pickup truck. You still have a huge bed in the back for like carrying stuff back from Home Depot or for your job or something. This thing's only going to be available in the like four-door version too, so that's the one that families can actually use. I'm just really excited by this. It is so much better looking than the ugly Cybertruck. So I think this is really interesting. This is a really good year for Ford and electric cars, right?
Every time you say frunk, Dev, I don't know if you're saying a different F word. But my
what could you be talking about?
I don't know. My question for you, for you is this the Ford vehicle that Biden somehow accidentally announced during Google
I/O? Accidentally, it's all purposeful.
Straight
come
up.
On, like
okay.
it was right behind him during his the day before they officially announced it. It was right behind him, and he mentioned Ford has an electric. You know, it's fine. They don't need to be secretive about it. Yeah. Biden took off in this car, and like, there's footage of him just like speeding down a jetway with the Secret Service kind of running after him. So this is
frunk.
Cool. This is cool. Between this and the Mustang EV, it does seem like Ford is onto some really cool stuff. So I think this is exciting. I am paying more attention to electric cars and hybrid cars and things like that. I'm not a normal car person, but I do like the idea of computers on wheels. So we'll be keeping a close eye on this for sure. Sherlyn, you also want to talk about some new display types from Samsung?
I love how in the week with Google I/O companies are like, no, we're still going to shoot you with all kinds of news anyway.
Other
stuff. Samsung. Yeah, right. In addition to Apple reviews and Google I/O. So Samsung over at its little, it had an event sort of under the Samsung display umbrella this week. And I believe it was on May 17th. So maybe Monday. Yes. It had a Display Week 2021 event showing off some concept devices like a double folding OLED panel on a sort of smartphone. When it's unfolded, which you remember twice, the screen has sort of a width or size of 7.2 inches. You know, so when it's obviously when it's folded, it's like a lot tinier than that. And then it also showed off a slidable OLED display. It extends horizontally, kind of like some of the TCL prototypes we've seen and talked about, and LG as well. And then we also saw at this event a 17-inch foldable panel. So this would be more for a tablet or like a PC style device, maybe running Windows, similar to Lenovo's ThinkPad X1 Fold. So Samsung's like, you know, has sort of been leading, I think, the race in terms of getting consumer ready foldable devices out there, but not really showing off much more by way of like interesting prototypes like that, the way that TCL has actually been more active in doing. But it's really cool to see that Samsung's like, we know you, we hear you like trifolds, we hear you like rolling OLEDs, here you go. And the idea that we might get these different devices or device types from Samsung soon, well, soon being a relative word here, is also very intriguing. V, you're big on foldables. What do you think about these prototypes?
Does anyone want a trifold device? Like,
you're saying
obviously,
this? You?
Yes, this is me. It's me, the dummy, who went out and bought my own Galaxy Z Fold 2. Like, that's enough. But no, it's really interesting to see Samsung kind of experimenting with this stuff out loud. As you pointed out, TCL has been doing this for a while. And if nothing else, it's helpful for them to just, like, be able to gauge what people think they might want to do with these things. Because we're still in, like, smartphones have looked like slabs of glass and metal for, God, like a decade now. We're now on the precipice of like really wild new form factors, but no one knows what people want because no one's used one yet. So I'm glad to see Samsung continue to try this out. They have said that they will be doing a sort of more accessible push into foldables this year. So we're all sort of taking that to mean they're going to be cheaper. So maybe we'll see something like this actually go on sale. but
and not prohibitively priced. And yeah, I do agree that that might be the meaning of the word accessible in that sort of context there, not like for people with
I almost feel like we're reaching like an innovation precipice here too, where it's like, I don't think foldables are ever going to be as big as smartphones were, like as an overall consumer shift and you know, the way we use our tech and stuff. It is a nice thing to have. It's a nice to have. It's not a must have. Whereas the iPhone, compared to, you know, literally everything that came before it, was, oh my God, this is a must have.
Yeah.
We all need a phone like this.
Change the way we live.
It changes our lives. So, you know, hey, I think foldables are probably going to have a much smaller market, but it's cool. It's cool to play with. I just, I don't feel like it'll ever be essential to a lot of folks.
We'll see.
We shall see. Maybe. And maybe I'm looking forward to like more. I think as we move forward, more people are going to do the sort of like, let's separate ourselves more from our tech rather than let's integrate more of it. Like, I think the tech asceticism, like the idea of being mindful and being careful about how you embed yourself in tech and how you live with it is going to be a big deal moving forward too. So foldables, I think, will kind of suffer because of that. But maybe. Anyway, let's talk about more tech that we're going to be diving into. Something big that happened this week is Amazon announced that they're going to be offering lossless audio on Amazon Music at no extra charge. That used to be, you actually used to be able to get hi-fi tracks by paying a little more. No extra charge. They did that because a couple hours later, Apple also announced that Apple Music will be offering lossless audio at no extra charge, along with Dolby Atmos 3D audio, which I think for a lot of people will probably be the cooler thing because that gives you like simulated surround sound basically with music. This is a big change we're seeing this year. We also know Spotify said that it is going to be doing its own lossless like CD quality service, Spotify Hi-Fi, later this year. We don't even know what that's going to be or what it's going to cost. But given the fact that Apple and Amazon are doing it for free now, I feel like that puts Spotify in a bit of a bind. Do you guys care at all about lossless audio, like about this higher quality stuff?
Not moi, because I'm a very
basic girl. You don't care.
Look, I will say, if I'm a Spotify person, like that's where I've chosen to invest my time, you better believe I have my like download settings set to maximum quality.
Maximum download, yeah.
But at the same time, I'm listening to them over like AirPods or like the Bose noise canceling 700s, which sound fine, but no one's going to say those are like premium audio.
And they're also limited. So they are limited. Any wireless headphones, they are limited by the Bluetooth codecs and kind of like the maximum quality those can spit out. Let me just say, I think for 98-99% of users out there, they will probably never take full advantage of lossless audio tech because you need to have a dedicated headphone amp. You know, you need to have a good pair of wired headphones that could really capture the nuances of all that extra stuff. If you're in a noisy environment, if you're traveling, if you're in your car, if you're on the subway, having those giant files will not make a difference at all. You will literally not hear it because there's too much other noise to even really take advantage of that. So that's one thing. I think like there's like, you can only go so far with lossless audio. The funny thing is that none of the AirPods so far, not even the $549 AirPods Max supports lossless audio. Now, here's why it's interesting. It's because, sure, in wireless mode, I wouldn't expect the AirPods Max to support it. You would think in wired mode, right, like just plugging it into your phone or device or something, that it could get higher quality. No, not at all, because actually this the DAC on that thing is limited to the best wireless quality, you know, because it is meant to be wireless first. So unlike, you know, a normal pair of headphones that you plug in with a 3.5 millimeter jack, you're paying a lot of money for quality that you can't actually hear on the AirPods Max. So I found that hilarious. Nobody's talking about those things anymore, right? Do you have those, V?
Which ones? The AirPods Max?
The Max.
No. Yeah. No. No.
They I know were you like, were tempted. You were like,
Look, everything, some money. Everything tempts me. I have the lowest threshold for buying anything of any human imaginable. And it's bitten me in the ass several hundreds of times. And with the AirPods Max, I say no, sir. This is where I put my
foot. This is where you drew the line.
Really? Okay. We'll see because one day we'll see V rolling up with the AirPods.
You will never. Yeah.
No, you will.
We will. We will totally see that. But anyway, here's the thing. If you want to take advantage of Apple lossless music or any of this stuff, buy a good pair of headphones or be prepared to like build out a good pair of hi-fi speakers or something, or a good hi-fi speaker setup, and get yourself an amp. Like you won't just be able to do it with a simple pair of wireless headphones or AirPods or something. Dolby Atmos sound, for a lot of people, maybe a cool little thing. We've seen demos of spatial audio on AirPods, basically simulated surround sound. So I've tried out some demos of this. I don't think it's a game changer either. It is a cool feature to have on headphones. Just the idea of like you're standing in front of a live band rather than hearing two channels of audio at you. But it's not earth shattering to me. It's a cool thing to have again. Let's move on to some other stuff. Sherlyn, IFA, IFA is canceled.
So IFA for some reason, IFA, which is, by the way, Europe's version of CES, except for, to me, it happens on a smaller scale, is an electronic show in Europe, and it happens in Berlin. Now, last month, the organizers of IFA, I'm not going to attempt to say the name because I'm definitely going to butcher it, were like, yo, we're definitely doing a full-scale return to this show, and then it's now been canceled. Because since it announced that, I think a lot of companies just were like, we're not going to IFA. I don't know what you're thinking about this full-scale return. Plus, there are, like we said many times on the show already, still a lot of places in the world still plagued by COVID-19 and its variants. So that always seemed like a dumb idea. So now IFA has, this weekend, at least the organizers were like, oh yeah, we're canceling it. Because coronavirus infection numbers in Germany are actually higher now than they were at this time last year.
This is awful. Yeah. Yep.
Imagine that, because the UK variant is one that we've been keeping an eye on. And then more recently, the India variant. And then there's variants in Indonesia and other parts of the world that just didn't feel like they had enough foresight when they said they were going to go ahead with it this year. They're finally
like
doing
the
right thing.
It seems like the story of 2020 and 2021. Yeah, yeah. I hope more countries get more access to vaccines. I hope more Americans start taking the vaccines. Because, yeah, we are not out of the... in the clear yet. Yeah,
we're not. And I one thing that America I feel like has done faster than a lot of countries in the world is get its people vaccinated. In Singapore, I know my parents both are, you know, fully vaxxed up. My brother only just got his first dose and he's like very close to my age. And
but that was
people,
because they were restricting who was getting it too, right? Like it wasn't
true.
Open to
yeah.
him for
there
a while.
Was like classes of people, so like my parents are older, and then there's people in different like lines of work that were allowed to get it sooner. I heard that Taiwan also recently had like 200 cases out of nowhere. Well, not really nowhere, a pilot, but stuff is still happening. It feels
stuff
like
happens
we're
really fast, yeah.
Really quickly. We're excited for a return to normalcy. I understand that. But we really need to be. This is just my weekly soapbox of like how we need to be careful, wash our hands, and, you know, soap in a box. But anyway, this news was also announced this week. Just as a recap, though, at IFA, we usually see a lot of news about audio devices, wearables.
It's like a lot of TVs,
lots of TVs, tablets, and laptops. And eat a lot of good food in Germany. A lot of Wiener Schnitzel in Berlin. Davindra, I feel like you went to one IFA. Yeah,
we went to one with you guys. Yeah.
Yes, that was pretty cool.
It was fun. IFA's good. Yeah, good food.
IFA's a good show. IFA.
I cannot wait till we can all travel again safely and eat good food while working too much. That's the story of our lives. Let's move on. One other little bit of news. Microsoft killed Windows 10X officially. We have talked about this a bit. This was supposed to be the dual screen variant of Windows 10. It was supposed to be in the Surface Neo. It's not happening. We don't know where the Surface Neo is. I think because the Duo was so poorly received, Microsoft was like, let's not do this just yet. I can understand why. And we have seen some demos of dual screen PCs from other companies. Again, to me, this feels like folding phones. You are not solving a problem. You are doing this cool tech because you kind of can. You know, it's like, hey, look at that. It's like it's like a dog walking on two legs. You're like, oh, that's funny to see. I don't know if it'll actually solve any problems for anybody or is worth an extra cost or anything. So, yeah.
I think they were exploring something to see what could work, and it sounds like this is them going, we tried and it's like nearly impossible, and it's maybe too hard to be worth the effort. I don't know, V, if you were excited for 10X.
I really wanted to use the Surface Neo.
I just wanted to use the Surface Neo. I did want to use that.
Yeah. My God.
So cute.
Like, talk about experimenting out loud. Like, this is a thing that I'd actually legitimately want to try. And the fact that I never will kind of kills me.
I wouldn't say never. So they are bringing some Windows 10X features, at least some of the ideas, like better app security. I think eventually a better touchscreen keyboard and stuff like that will be rolled into Windows 10 proper. I don't think this means dual screen devices are dead entirely in the Windows world. It just means Microsoft is not doing a separate OS variant for it. But man, they just keep failing at this because they announced Windows 10S with the first Surface laptop, and that was supposed to be a lockdown, streamlined version of Windows where you could only install apps from the App Store. And it was such a dumb idea because nobody uses Windows like that. So, and they had to turn about face pretty quickly too. Yeah. So again, it seems like rather than launching it and seeing it fail, because they kind of know it probably would, they were like, let's just focus on Windows 10 and see what we could build with that. Yeah. Fair.
Well, that's it, I think, right? For our little roundup of big news this week. There's been more. There's more. There's like a little bit of Qualcomm news, by the way. Snapdragon 778 was announced and new 5G, you know, technologies and references. Please go to Engadget.com to read that because we don't have the time to tell you all of it today here on this. We're already running long as it is, but it's been a big week, people. I'm glad you're here with us.
Send us some mail. How about that? I'd love to get some reader mail.
We have some mail we're also going to get to. Yeah, next
eventually,
time.
Eventually. Send us mail at podcastengadget.com. We would love to take your questions in the future. Let's move on to what we've been working on. I'm just dead, Trillin. So you tell me, what are you working on?
I'm still playing with the Android 12 beta a little bit. I will continue to update my hands-on with it as I learn more things from my experiences and with Google. And I am starting to review a new interesting laptop-y thing. I kind of don't want to let people know yet because I don't want people to beat me to the punch. But top priority, taking some time off. Next week, I will not be here. Hopefully, fingers crossed. I'm still waiting on the... all clear signal.
You don't
nothing
know.
Big
okay.
happening.
I mean, I feel like you're all clear. There is Microsoft Build is next week, so thank you, Sherlyn, for running away during that.
We are going to get some news from that.
We will split up the Build news day anyway. Sherlyn needs a break. Everybody, please email Sherlyn and tell her to take a vacation.
Oh, okay. You can do that. Yes. Yeah. But V, what are you working on?
I got to tell you guys, I'm keeping things loosey-goosey for a little while. I might be doing like a roundup of like AirTag accessories. So if you have any of those you want me to try out, sure, I'll take a look at them. I think I might write about like the fake Peloton bike that I built for myself.
Yes, you
just
should.
In case you don't want to spend $2,000 on a bike. Like, we can do that. Just kind of having a good time for a little while. Feels good.
Yeah, you're going to help Devendra on Build, you know, all of that.
Yes, I did already offer before the show. Hit me up. I got you, bud.
All right, let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. Sherlyn, what is your secret?
So I struggled really, really hard this week. But last minute, I got a late-breaking exclusive embargo offer from Microsoft. And basically, the company teamed up with Asian media company and record label 88 Rising to generate an AI-based never-ending remix of this thing called Too Many Tears.ai. It is off of a singer and rapper, Warren Hu, his latest single, Too Many Tears. So basically, what Microsoft and 88 Rising have done is take that song and then also send out some technical specialist to the San something Valley. Oh gosh, I need to get the San Gabriel Valley, I want to say. Let me double check. And then put a camera there, send a 24/7 feed to AI, and the AI is kind of looking at like transitions between sunset, sunrise, dusk, and dawn, that sort of thing, and using stems from the music to create sort of a musical background to the scenes that are also playing on screen. You can go check this out on TooManyTears.ai if you want to see. My thing is like Microsoft's whole like collaborations with entertainers like, you know, Warren Hu, and in the past Bjork, by the way, has resulted in these like really interesting musical background music things that you can, now that you're spending so much time at home, put on in the background. I'm gonna go do that. And it's, you know, Microsoft also pointed out that the this project is part of celebrating Asian American representation, I guess, and some of the, and that valley, that area is also one of the most diverse in the area that Microsoft said. So that's my, one of my Asian shout outs this week. But the other one I wanted to shout out, I was like, what am I going to shout out that is Asian? Because I haven't watched a lot of Asian things recently. Haven't been looking at Asian creators lately. I was like, you know what? I'm going to do a throwback to way back when I used to recommend all kinds of crap on this podcast. I'm going to recommend you some Asian food.
Okay. Please.
If you are wondering what to eat this week or this month, go all Asian. Dude, there's so many different kinds of Asian food. Thai food, Malay food, Indonesian food.
It sounds like you've prepared a book report for a book you haven't read. Charlotte, what are you doing?
Wait, is that your actual recommendation?
Just get some Asian food for a month. You know, get some food. Get some takeout.
Sichuan, hot pot, dry pot, Asian beers. Guinness.
Can I mute Sherlyn from this chat? Yeah.
This is like every non-work conversation with Sherlyn.
This is true. Like as soon as we're off work mode, she's like, what are we going to eat, guys? Like what's happening? Yeah.
Anyway, that's amazing. My pick, amazing. Asian food.
Great.
All right. I'm going to, V, I bet you did. The job.
You did your homework.
You completed the assignment here.
I did.
Do you have any pop culture recommendations? Yes.
Call on me.
That's more than food.
So, I don't know if you guys know this about me. I've basically given up on regular television and most streaming services. Just like, as a thing, I get the vast majority of all my entertainment from YouTube. And the YouTube channel that has ensorcelled me so thoroughly for the past few weeks. And it really has been a source of great comfort to me as I've been reviewing stuff and just sort of like figuring out stuff about my life is a channel called Project Farm. And this is a gentleman, Devinder, you might be into this.
Yeah.
This is a gentleman who, among other things, tests, you know, what kinds of oil would be best to use in your car? What kind of drill bits last the longest?
I love and are those good for, values. Like, the little granular things like this. Like, I am really excited about drill bits. Yes.
This person is incredible. Mm-hmm. He just one of my favorite videos, he bought a fake Makita drill power screwdriver thing. And that was $30 and compared it to the actual Makita that it was based on, which is like $130.
Yep.
Just like went full out. It's like a 12-minute video. It's like
drilling full, until it dies.
Yeah. Just like which one can drill faster, what's like the cutoff point. Yep. He connects them to each other to just like crank both and see which one wins.
Yep.
Obviously the real Makita wins. I cannot begin to impress upon people the sort of granularity and just sort of the thoughtfulness of his approach to testing which tape measure is best or which ratchet strap is the best ratchet strap. So if you even, I don't own a home. I'm not a handy person, but I aspire to be one day maybe. And this guy gives me hope that maybe one day with the right tools that he finds, maybe I'll be good at something.
You'll be good at something. Hey, find some YouTubers. Here's the thing. Like the thing about YouTube is that no matter what your interest is, you will find people doing stuff you're into and also weird random things like this that, I get really into as well. So thank you for the shout out, V.
I'm going to add to my homework. Yeah. Sorry, really quick. There's YouTubers.
You failed. You've already gotten an F.
You follow that. And also, crap, what did I want to say? Oh, also Mythic Quest Season 2. That's my homework.
Good job.
It's out. Go watch
good
it.
Job. Good job. It's out. I will also be watching that. Mythic Quest is good. Watch it, folks. I'm kind of the old fogey, I guess, who likes shows and scripted narrative entertainment, such as movies. But I want to shout out The Nevers, which aired its mid-season, first season finale this week. I think I talked about this when it first launched. This is Joss Whedon's new thing. It is the most Joss Whedon-y thing to arrive because it's like mixtures of Buffy and Angel and Firefly and everything. Even his comic stuff is in here. It is a weird show to be talking about now because Whedon is basically nuclear. He's a little toxic because of reports from just how crappy he was as a boss and how he kind of used his influence to bed people he worked with. So not great, not a great dude. He left the show after these episodes and is being show run by different people now. I do want to say though, as a show, it is good. You know, it is very tropey. It is very much like things you've seen before with Whedon, but it does some really cool stuff. It is about people in the like Victorian era who some who get powers. When the show was initially pitched, it was actually we thought it was just women getting powers, but it's actually a little more complicated than that. So powers are happening. And then this mid-season finale drops, and it is one of the wildest things I've ever seen on TV. And it actually harkens back to another Whedon project where he does a big surprising thing. That's Dollhouse, a show that nobody saw. Yeah, I think if you like Whedon stuff, if you are into sci-fi and fantasy and you know superhero stuff, it is worth checking out The Nevers. It is definitely worth getting to episode 6. And why don't you tweet at me when you get there? Tweet at me your reaction, because I think it does some really bold and interesting stuff for TV. And I like being surprised by my narratives and by the things I watch. So The Nevers season 1 is good. Don't listen to Rotten Tomatoes, because Rotten Tomatoes reviews were just the first couple episodes. Shaky, sure. It gets really good. I like the cast. I like the characters. And I'll keep watching because, hey, Whedon's not going to be involved anymore. And there's a strong cast. There's a strong crew of writers and people working on it, too. So, yeah, I hope the show lives on. Check out The Nevers, everybody.
Been meaning to watch it. We'll do it after you've given us such a strong recommendation.
And yeah, please tweet at me once you get to episode 6. Once you start episode 6, to be honest.
I heard a lot of things about that.
Once you
that,
hit
yeah.
play, you're like, what is it's going to basically be me and Alex Kranz just geeking out about
oh,
what is
no,
going on.
Oh no, you've been talking to her about this? Oh Lord.
No, we need to catch up. We need to do a Nevers chat. Okay. But anyway, that's it for me. I have food recommendations. Please eat. Please eat food. I mean that. Please recommend. Yeah, please energize yourself.
Some good instant noodle brands. How about that? Ramen brands.
Wait, no. If we're doing good instant
no,
noodle.
No. Okay.
Brands,
fine.
Mama,
fine.
Get the.
You've ruined everything. Food Rex.
Noodles,
food okay. Rex. V. Go.
Mama duck noodles. Mm. The sort of like really cheap, like super
the
cheap
Mama
Thai
really good,
fake
yeah.
duck flavored noodles.
I like the there's the Korean spicy noodle that has like the
chicken. Oh, Nongshim.
Nongshim. Yeah. Nice. He's it's good. It's too spicy because I have to use like half the spice pack because otherwise it's like I can't even eat it. You've gone too far.
Really good. Yeah, it's not the crazy fire spice one. I don't think that one's another one. Sanyang, I think. I can't remember.
Yeah.
My favorite are Prima does good Singaporean laksa. We're talking about this on the chat. And Maggie. I like Maggie a lot. Myojo is another really good one with the sesame oil. So here you go, Asian ramen noodle brand.
Wait, there's sorry. One more. Migoreng. The sort Migoreng's of Indian good. Garlicky noodles. Delicious. I've
it's all good. Hey, the amazing thing is you can get good noodles no matter where you are now. Even if you don't live near a store that carries these things, which even major grocery stores do, you could get good noodles on Amazon or something. So get them. Have some noodles in the background. Happy lunch, everybody. I think we're all really hungry.
That's it for our episode, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter and at the /filmcast at /film.com.
And if you need him, Chris Velasco is online at.
You can find me at Chris Velasco on Twitter, or you can email me at v@engadget.com.
Or waiting in line for the next $3,000 Apple product, right?
No, shut up. I'm now on Amazon buying more duck noodles.
Oh, no.
Better.
Or at
cheaper.
An Apple store.
Yeah.
If you want to send me your questions about Asian food in general, because clearly I'm such an expert now, I am at Sherlyn Low on Twitter. Email us your thoughts, questions, and feedback at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes. And subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.
Once again, we'd like to take a second to thank our sponsor, Mouser Electronics. Not only does Mouser stock the world's widest selection of semiconductors and electronic components, they also offer an original content series called Empowering Innovation Together. Each month, EIT takes a deep dive into the hottest tech trends, and this month the focus is on 5G. Check out podcasts, articles, infographics, videos, and more at mouser.com/empoweringinnovation.
Those beige beauties.